The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Jessica Elgott. It's exactly a year since Britain voted to leave the EU, and after a turbulent 12 months in politics, this latest week saw a watered-down Queen's speech, election manifesto pledges junked, and an untested majority take their seats in Parliament. The Conservatives are in office, but are they in power? Meanwhile, as residential tower blocks are revealed to have flammable cladding, national and local government are still battling to get a grip of the aftermath of the Grenfell Tower disaster. Plus, we meet some of the parliamentary newbies as they collect their passes and find their places on the green benches of the House of Commons.
First day, it felt like I just enrolled for Hogwarts because there's staircases going everywhere and it's a complete maze.
Joining me for all of this, I have The Guardian political commentators Anne Perkins and Raphael Baer, and our writer Dawn Foster, who has spent the past week covering Grenfell Tower. But let's start with this week in Parliament. Last week, Theresa May seemed to win over the Tories by apologising for the campaign. But, Raph, this week feels very different.
Yes. The essential thing to remember about Theresa May's position now is that she is secure as Prime Minister and as leader of the Conservative Party, not because Tory MPs think she's doing a good job or trust her or even kind of really want her to do it, but because they've all the various different factions have different reasons for keeping her there temporarily. So you've got a whole bunch of people who essentially just don't want Boris Johnson to ever be Prime Minister, and because he's the sort of readiest candidate, that you've got to keep Theresa May there. You've got hard Brexiteers who think a kind of a diminished Theresa May, who is committed to quite a hard Brexit, is their best bet, that they will have leverage over her. You've got the opposite. You've got kind of soft Brexiteers and Liberals who also hope that they will somehow have leverage, or that they need Theresa May to stick around for long enough that they can kind of come up with some sort of generational change or some way of getting a Ruth Davidson type character to replace her. So she's in this awful caretaker, kind of wounded, lame duck caretaker, if I can mix my metaphors, lame caretaker maybe, position. She's in an appalling position, really, that the only thing she can do is kind of hobble through this process while her own party works out how it can replace her in a way that doesn't set off some chain reaction resulting in a second general election and possibly Jeremy Corbyn becoming Prime Minister.
And the Tory whips have apparently told MPs to keep all of their evenings free, you know, for the next couple of years. Every vote looks like it could be on a knife edge. We still don't really have a proper deal with the DUP. Is this sustainable for a parliament and to get things done?
It'll come at a very, very high cost, both in policy terms and in personal terms, I think, as people who, you know, can remember the tough years from 76 to 78 can still recall. I think the only thing that's missing from Raph's very complete description of May's travails is the policy agenda she's facing. I mean, you hinted at it in your introduction. She's not just this wounded caretaker, a rather fetching image, but she's a wounded caretaker coping with one damn thing after another, of which, of course, the hugest and most long-lasting is Brexit. And managing that through Parliament, as Raph hinted, is going to be enormous. It would have been a challenge if she'd actually won the mandate that the majority she set out to win. And as she is now, I think it's really anybody's guess how it might transpire, what we might be saying in 2 years' time.
Dawn, probably a lot of Labour MPs, probably a lot of Tory MPs as well, will welcome what seems to be the junking of a lot of the Tory policies in the election manifesto, you know, grammar schools, changes to social care, abolishing the winter fuel allowance, the school cuts seems to as well, they seem to be rethinking that. Do you think we should consider these policies to be dead and buried, or do you think they're just resting?
I think there's no way she can really do it with the current very, very slim working majority she has, you know, even if she gets a DUP on side. So I think most of the Labour MPs I've spoken to are particularly happy about the schools, about, you know, grammar schools being kicked into the long grass. I think also that, I mean, ordinarily, you would, if you got rid of these policies because they were very unpopular, you would then have some popularity come back. But instead, it's just made her look weak. It's actually hurt the Tories by getting rid of a lot of these things. So I think, you know, in the long term, it's not going to help them. And I think that going back on them, putting them in the manifesto, then junking them will actually make the policies a lot more toxic in the future. I think the electorate weren't very happy with them. And seeing Theresa May drop them then means that they are pretty toxic going forward.
Raph, if anything illustrates that how much Theresa May has been fighting a battle on two fronts, she's in Brussels today. What's been going on there?
It's interesting. This is an EU council meeting, so we're one of just a regular summit of heads of government of EU member states. And if just a few people had voted differently on this day a year ago, this would be the moment that the UK would be taking over the presidency, actually, of the European Council, and it would be an ordinary summit meeting. There would be 28 fully fledged EU members. Britain voted to leave the European Union, so there's 27 kind of still fully fledged EU members, and then the one slightly weird in the anti-chamber, half in, half out member, which is the UK. So Theresa May has gone sort of as if, just sort of fulfilling the protocols as if a full EU head of government, because legally that's what she is. She presented her account of you know, one of her proposals for the negotiations, the Brexit negotiations, which is about offering rights to EU citizens currently living in the UK. And the other 27 member states essentially said, that's very nice, Theresa, but actually there's a negotiation being led by Michel Barnier. That happens, that's a different process. So thank you for telling us that. Now you may now leave the room and we will carry on being the EU without you. And there's no way that this isn't just sort of humiliating and just a reminder that while the ostensible purpose of Brexit was to regain power and sovereignty and somehow sort of bolster the UK's credentials as a more autonomous sovereign state, so far what has actually happened is the UK has been completely diminished because the British Prime Minister's ability to influence this group of people to take a lead role that it once had in this forum has very visibly, palpably been taken away from the UK. And then separately, there is a track of negotiations that actually started on Monday, where the very first thing that happened is the UK completely folded on one of its key demands, which was to sort of affect the timetable of Brexit discussions and try and do a sort of longer-term free trade deal in parallel with Brexit talks. That's a different issue. But to finish the point, broadly what we are seeing now is that some of the abstract theory of what Brexit was supposed to achieve just crashing really hard into the brick wall of Brexit reality, which is there's 27 of them and there's only one of us.
I mean, it was just so noticeable watching May's body language as she left that meeting last night. I mean, she just, and I'm not surprised, she looked absolutely shattered. She'd been on her feet in the Commons in the morning for, an hour and a half, asking, you know, really difficult and painful questions. And then she has to kind of completely change gear and go and be head of government. And she's really has it thrown back in her face. It is humiliating for her, and frankly, it's humiliating for the country. And on top of that, we can't even get our way in the UN anymore.
I guess if you were going to try and be a little bit generous to Britain's tactics, bear with me. They have tried to get off this summit on the front foot, haven't they? They've said that they wanted Theresa May's come out with this offer to EU citizens. And that is an attempt, isn't it, to try and get Britain back on the front foot and get us, you know, as, in the position as being seen as the ones with something to offer. What do you think about that offer?
Well, it seems to me that she's actually come up with a sheen on what basically happens with all inward migration to the UK, EU or non-EU. And it's an offer she could perfectly well have made a year ago and got all of this off the headlines and out of the immediate political fire. The problem is not the offer she's made. And the problem with all these negotiations is her attitude to the European Court of Justice. And until she acknowledges that we cannot go it alone in the modern world without accepting arbitration of any international treaties by some non-British court, we're never going to get anywhere. We can't join the WTO unless we accept International Trade Arbitration Court.
Also, can I just interject something here on that point? It's very important that what Theresa May has done with this EU citizens offer, this is going to sound like a kind of technical procedural point about the EU, but it's very important. She has presented it to the Council. Now, the Council is where EU heads of government all get together. It is the supreme executive decision-making bit of the EU, basically. Although Eurosceptics for a long time suggested that it was the European Commission was that. The Commission isn't that at all. The Council is the big one. It's where these things happen. It's where prime ministers, presidents hammer out compromises. Now, Theresa May naturally went to that forum and said, hey, look, I've got an idea. And what the other 27 said very clearly was, this is not the place where that's going to happen. So that's very interesting that you've got this plan. But actually, we've already decided the way the negotiation on Brexit is going to happen. It's going to happen through Michel Barnier. He's an appointee of the Commission, and he's going to talk to David Davis. And then so take your lovely plan for EU nationals and what's going to happen to them, give them back to David Davis, and he will present them to Michel Barnier, and then they will talk about that. So that is treating the UK as an external supplicant to the European Union, and Theresa May tried to come and say, hey, look, guys, I'm still one of you, we can do a deal. And they said, no, that's not how it works. Now, that is very profound in terms of what it signals about the resolution on the European side to not allow the UK to try and have its cake and eat it. That's very much no, you cannot. Yeah, there's a cake trolley outside. You go and decide what you want, and you might not even get that. We might give you a slice if you're lucky. And so just in terms of diplomacy and the process, that's actually, in a way, as important as the substance of what Theresa May was offering.
Dawn, the main thing to remember, I think, about this offer, isn't it, is that these are people's lives. These are people who have been waiting in limbo for a year for some kind of detail to become clear. And the offer isn't quite as good as what they've got now. It's nowhere near as good as what they've got now for people who've been here less than 5 years. What do you think, EU citizens here will make of it?
I think most of them will be very angry. I mean, I spoke to some of my friends who are EU citizens who were a bit worried about their status. They have partners over here, they have jobs over here. And they were very, very angry. They were particularly annoyed by the tone from Theresa May, that she kind of put it across as a very magnanimous, open offer, when actually, as you said, it's a lot worse than it currently is. And she was treating them as kind of some pawns in her game. And they were, very, very annoyed that the tone about Brexit during the campaign. So the fact that Theresa May said, no deal is better than a bad deal. And the fact that, very little has been said to these people beforehand. So most of them are very angry. I think it will be very, very difficult to work as well. And I don't think it will give much actual kind of solace to people whose lives are in limbo at the moment. And I just don't think any of it can go well at this point. I mean, I've got some friends who worked in the Department of Brexit in European Union. They've helped with the negotiation prep, etc. And every time I ask them, how do you think it will go? Every single person says, as far as they can see, the only outcome will be a bad deal, but it has to also have the appearance of a bad deal. So the UK can't come out and try and say, yes, we've done well. Everyone wants the UK to come out and look completely humiliated.
Well, you can follow all the drama in Westminster in real time on our Politics Live blog at theguardian.com/politics. Now, Westminster can be a forbidding place for those at the start of their parliamentary careers. Along with the sometimes medieval rules and customs, there are offices to staff, there are names to learn, and not to mention a maiden speech to prepare. New MPs are fairly easy to spot as they arrive fresh-faced in the Palace of Westminster.
So my name's Annalisa Dodds, and I'm the Labour MP for Oxford East. It felt a little bit like the first day of school, I suppose. We had to do a lot of registration and trying to get keys and that kind of thing. A number of us are still trying to sort out offices and working out which staff we'll have and that kind of thing. So not really focused on policy yet, and obviously trying to deal with casework from as soon as I was elected, because people can't choose when they might have a problem, and that's not going to rely on the electoral timetable. So really trying to be on top of that from day one where there's urgent cases. Given that I'm receiving over 600 emails a day, I have to kind of prioritise a bit at the moment, but obviously I am going to get back to absolutely all of those inquiries as soon as I can.
Moran, Lib Dem MP for Oxford West and Abingdon. Well, the first day was actually incredibly well organised by the House of Commons. We had a buddy and we were very quickly taken through all the induction stuff. You get taken from room to room, you get a security briefing, you get your passwords, it's all very well set up. And then the rest of the day actually feels now like a bit of a blur. Just doing media and meeting your colleagues for the first time, being a bit awestruck by seeing famous politicians wandering through the, atrium of Portcullis House that you've never really known before. So it's quite awe-inspiring being here. I think the weirdest thing, honestly, so far has been sitting in the House during the election of the Speaker. And as a teacher, I've spent my entire life so far telling students not to behave in the way that the parliamentarians were frankly behaving in that room, and jeering at each other across the benches. And I honestly felt embarrassed. And I don't quite know what to do about that, but I think I will maybe try and see if there's something I can do about that in the House, because we tell our kids not to behave this way, and that here are the leaders of the country behaving in a way that in any other forum would just not be acceptable.
Okay, Giles Watling, I'm the Member of Parliament for Clacton. on the first day, it felt like I just enrolled for Hogwarts, because there's staircases going everywhere, and it's a complete maze. But you get given your pass, and so I did probably one of the wisest things I ever did. Before I actually settled down with anybody or did anything, I just walked from place to place around the building and found where all the corridors went, or not, as the case may be. You know, I mean, it really is a rabbit warren. And I found various offices, the travel office, the pass office, the this office, the that office. The very first day, I had a buddy assigned to me, and she was very helpful. And she just took me from place to place to get everything sorted out. She knew where I had to go. So once that was done and I had my pass, I was let loose for a while, along with a lot of other frightened rabbits in the headlights. You know, that's the way it goes. I suppose the most difficult thing is that, of course, my fellow Conservative whips, they wanted to brief us on everything, and they've got a shed load of information, stuff that I'd never even thought of, really. And so we went from meeting after meeting after meeting, and at the end of the day you think, am I going to retain 10% of this that's been thrown at me? But it's amazing, you kind of do. Then suddenly you need to know about something, you sort of know where to go. The most wonderful thing is when you get in the House of Parliament, doesn't matter whether you're red, blue or whatever you do, the staff there are incredible. They are helpful and friendly to a T. The doorkeepers, the police, everybody, they just want to help you and ease your way in and along your journey as an MP, so that makes it much more bearable.
My name is David Lindon. I'm the new Member of Parliament for Glasgow East. Everything was absolutely fine until I got off the subway, came in here and realised that I hang my coat up somewhere different. So I went into the member's cloakroom and there's a coat hanger with a little pink ribbon on it, which is where I'm meant to hang my sword. So suffice it to say, when I was a staffer, I didn't have a sword to hang up, and as an MP, I don't have a sword to hang up either. But I think probably the strangest thing for me was last Tuesday when we were going for the election of the Speaker, and just sitting on those green benches for the first time and knowing that I was 20 yards away from the Prime Minister, and that for the next 5 years or for however long this Parliament runs, you know, it's my job to stand up and question her on behalf of my constituents. That's a pretty surreal experience, and a lot different from knowing where to get a cup of coffee. But the fact that the doorkeepers had made a very conscious effort to kind of know my name, and one of the things I find really strange is being called Mr. Lindon, because I'm 27, I'm from a fairly ordinary part of Glasgow. People don't address each other that way, so to have somebody with a kind of white bow tie and cocktails calling me Mr. Lindon was a bit of a bizarre experience, and one that I hope I don't get too used to, because you start getting too used to that, you don't have your feet in the ground.
The death toll from the Grenfell Tower fire stands for now at 79 people. As the government conducts fire tests on tower blocks around the country on hundreds of residential blocks, more than 350 households are still in emergency accommodation. Earlier this week, The Guardian's Owen Jones spoke to Labour MP David Lammy, who lost a friend in the disaster.
If burning in your home or suffocating in your home is not political, I don't know what is. If being poor and working class and all you're wanting is a fair crack of the whip isn't political, I don't know what is. If that isn't political, then I don't know what is. And let me just be clear. Yes, it's a tragedy. It's a scandal and it's a crime, and people's heads should be on the block for it. You know, when an individual commits a crime, if you or I committed a crime tomorrow, we'd be arrested and charged. When an organisation or a corporation or the state commits a crime, it's a tragedy.
That's the thing, isn't it? You'll get particularly...
Because they have deep pockets.
Yeah.
No, it's a crime. Has anyone been interviewed? Has anyone been charged? Have any computers, emails been seized, any documents? Because behind all of this is money and profit. I'm not saying that profit per se is a bad thing, but it drives certain actions, and it's clear to me that certain of those actions have led us to this point. Let's not just kick this into another inquiry that produces a report and no change. We had one. We had one in 2009 after like, this has also got to be held to be the crime that it is. As we sit here and speak, the death toll is now at 79 and rising. So this is clearly a tragedy of epic proportions. My belief is it's a crime of epic proportions, and no one's going to stop me saying that.
David Lammy there, and you can watch the whole of that interview on our website. Dawn Foster, you've been down at the site of the fire and speaking to survivors. Does it feel now like the authorities have got a full grip of the situation?
It's definitely improving on the ground every day I go down there. I mean, when I went down on Tuesday was the first time I actually saw officials in high-vis jackets. So most of the survivors I spoke to went to the community centres. It wasn't clear who was there, who wasn't. When I spoke to the council said, we do have people, you just don't know where they are. And I said, well, that's fine, but neither do the survivors. And so it was absolutely terrible. The family of like one of the missing 12-year-olds were still sleeping on floors up until Tuesday night. And I think now it's slowly we're getting to a point where people are managing to find what they need. And part of it is the fact that people have been told that their migration status won't have any impact on whether or not they can access healthcare, housing, support, etc. But I feel as well that the Grenfell response team, who were convened to take over from Kensington and Chelsea, just had such a terrible job on their hands. It was really difficult to pick things up. You know, we haven't had a disaster on this scale for a long time, you know, even though there were, you know, people planning for emergencies in Kensington and Chelsea. And it's very, very difficult to understand what needs to be done. And the fact that there was a week past pretty much, everything being so chaotic, really, really impacted very, very badly on survivors of the tower, but also the wider community who felt they were being ignored, and they were worried about asbestos blowing out of the building, about the structure of the building. You know, people still don't have hot water and gas because the gas mains for the whole estate was in the basement of Grenfell Tower.
I mean, now that we're sort of starting to see things go into motion, £5,000, you know, go to people to help them buy clothes and personal belongings, that people are starting to be rehoused, or at least there seems to be something in motion to get people into new permanent homes. Is that starting to restore trust in the system, in local and national government, or is it still going to take a long time to repair that?
I think it will take a long time. I think some people are coming forward and feel a little bit happier about it. I think the fact that there have been a lot of rumours flying around the estate shows exactly how little trust there is in the state at the moment. The residents I spoke to, the ones I interviewed, said that they'd been complaining for years. Some had been complaining as far back as 2009. You know, it really reached kind of a fever pitch around about 2013 when the renovation works were coming in. People were complaining to the council, they were complaining to their MP, they started their own groups, and they just felt completely ignored over and over again. And I think the fact that this happened after they'd warned the council, and the council's response was completely chaotic, just completely, utterly destroyed all of their trust. And it's going to take a long time to build up, and it will involve like a really, really targeted effort from the government. I think we can start seeing that with you know, the new Grenfell response team, who appear to be working very well with politicians and the community, but also, you know, people desperately want to know that if they live on the estate, they can stay on there. If they're in the tower, they can get permanent housing.
Theresa May was very heavily criticised for her response, and she seems now to realise the magnitude of some of the mistakes she made early on. She's stood up in the House yesterday and she apologised. Do you think that she's permanently damaged by this?
I think really it just plays into the narrative that's already well established about her inability to relate and to convey any kind of degree. Nobody will ever forget that day after when she kind of goes and talks privately off camera to the firemen, and then, you know, an hour later Corbyn's there hugging people, wiping their tears, promising to speak up for them. It was so stark. And I thought she made a very graceful apology in the Commons yesterday, but it was a week too late. I also felt I'm sure that she's trying to do the right thing in the short term. I'm not sure she's either got the imagination or the courage to make the big offer on social housing, for example, that would challenge the Tories' friends in the building industry and say, this is what we're going to do. This is a day, today, for the first time in history, the FT and the Times have both written first leaders arguing for more big expanse of social house building. And that shows where the mood of the country has got to. And May should have capitalised on that to challenge the house builders to do it.
Because, Raf, it's not just about, is it, that people are angry about the clearly catastrophic errors that were made in this one tower. People are angry about what it says about the system.
Yes, I think, Anne put it very well, I thought, actually. You know, that there are just a sense that the Prime Minister has now come to embody a sort of an ethos of insensitivity, and that which also sort of reaches way back and touches a sense of, you know, problems that the Conservative Party has in being seen to, or being perceived as just simply not caring about, you know, large sections of society. But, and also, you know, the feeling that we're now many years, decades even, into, as it were, sort of an ideological era where the presumption is that things can be outsourced to the private sector because that will be a more efficient way of delivering certain goods, that accountability falls between the gaps between where something is commissioned by government and the person who's actually supposed to be providing that service. It might not only be in the private sector, but might be subcontracted out several degrees away from whoever the elected official who once decided something needed to be done was sitting. So that whole apparatus, I'm trying to avoid using the word neoliberalism here because there's so much dispute about what it means and it's not very helpful. But the broad ideological idea that has got us to the point where there's just no clear connection of accountability between a politician saying this is the thing we want to do and where that thing is delivered, how it's delivered, and whether it's adequately funded, that now seems to be really kind of undermined and tottering. I on a human level, I feel a certain sympathy for Theresa May because she's now presiding over this moment of what feels like a quite significant unraveling of a whole set of political propositions that she's just always taken for granted. She didn't expect to be there. She looks sort of physically as if she's sort of just struggling to get through it because there's just so much of it on top of Brexit. And one of the defining characteristics of her as a politician, and always has been, is a complete lack of agility and spontaneity. So she was quite effective at the Home Office at sort of disappearing for a while, making a calculation and pulling off a political maneuver when she had enough time to prepare for it. And I think she's never been able to do, and it showed up in the campaign and it's been shown up in the last week and we'll see it more and more, is that a kind of natural fleetness of foot and spontaneity and capacity to do things quickly and act with political agility. I just don't think she's capable of that, and she's just not equal to the task of governing at this moment.
There is going to be a judge-led inquiry into Grenfell, and you know, but the one thing that we know about those kind of inquiries, Bloody Sunday or Hillsborough or the Iraq, you know, the Iraq War, the Chilcot inquiry became sort of a running joke about how long it had taken. They're not quick, and they're not always the last word on everything. And Dawn, I'll ask you, what do you think it needs to do, this inquiry, for residents to have confidence in what it's saying?
I think it needs to be obviously very, very comprehensive. I think residents really need to be at the centre of it. So ordinarily you would go through kind of paperwork and look at supply chains, but I think residents really, really want to be at the front and centre. They want as many of them as possible to be heard, and also people who knew the people who've deceased to be heard as well. So I think it needs to have that right at the forefront. But I also agree that, you know, Sadiq Khan has called for a summary of what went wrong to come out in the summer, because he just thinks that if you have an inquest, then it does take years and people want answers now and people are speculating now. So I think that we need to have some form of like interim report for the families this summer, just saying what went wrong and what can be done to stop it from happening again quickly.
I can't see why they don't ask Francis Kirkham, the judge who's a building expert who did the Lackenhall House inquest. It wasn't a formal inquiry. I mean, I suppose the danger is that she'll come at it wearing her Lackenhall House glasses and see in Grenfell what she found at Lackenhall. But it does seem to echo that in so many different ways. Not least, you know, one of the things about Lackenhall House was the way that safety inspections and fire inspections fell between the gaps. And you kind of think that's almost certainly what happened at Grenfell. And you'd thought those sort of findings probably could be realised quite quickly. I suppose I know there are all sorts of complexities on the legal front, but...
I mean, the urgency as well, it's not just... it is about getting justice for the victims and for the residents, but it is also about those, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of people living in tower blocks across the country who also need to know as quickly as possible whether, you know, similar mistakes were made that could have put them at risk.
And it's interesting there that that becomes a problem of sort of state capacity. I mean, you need to know what's on the sides of these buildings and how many buildings are affected, and as you say, need to offer people the reassurance. But that involves people who have the professional capability and the time and the whatever technical equipment they need to do that job. And you do feel, again, that leads you back to this question of austerity and budget and a political project to shrink down the state over many years, feeling as if it's really hit the buffers, just because actually you can take away this, as it were, the supply of government, and you can keep doing that and keep doing it, but what it doesn't actually ever ultimately shrink the demand for government when there's a problem and people say, well, this is government's job, it's the state's job to be sorting this out. Now, ideological conservatives might say, well, people shouldn't have that feeling. They've been bred to think that by the nanny state, and we need to wean them off it, and they should be a bit more self-reliant. And that would be an interesting radical conservative view on things. But at this very moment, in this particular country, it feels like there is quite a lot of unsatisfied demand for government. And at the mundane technical level of working out whether dwellings that people rely on are safe for them to live in.
Dawn, do you think the other thing that I think is interesting, what Raf said about the problems with austerity and how that might affect even, you know, people's capacity to perform safety inspections in the wake of this disaster. Rachel Reeves said in the Commons that she thought that just to install sprinklers in the tower blocks just in her constituency would cost the local authority £30 million. Do you think that the sheer scale of the cost and the resources that are going to be needed to make things safe is something that will be a wake up call to the government?
Yeah, I think so. If you look at just how much the fallout from Grenfell is going to cost, not just on a human level but on an actual cash basis, and then you look at exactly how much was saved, which is a very, very small sum of money. You know, I think it's one of the things where people, you know, attack the state, say you don't need it, but obviously when you do and it's not there, then everything falls apart. And we've seen that in the run-up to Grenfell. We've seen it in the fallout afterwards. And I think that this will be a big wake-up call. I think that a lot of people will be really asking questions about outsourcing. I think the Camden story is incredible. The fact that either there's a breakdown in communication or something's gone wrong, but Camden were under the impression that the panels on the outside of one of their towers were non-flammable, and then found out when they sent them to the government testing lab that they were flammable. So I think that there are going to be a lot of questions about outsourcing, a lot of questions about exactly what role the state should have in housing when we've had decades of the state moving out, and this is pretty much what we have the housing crisis.
That might have been what had happened at Grenfell as well, yeah. Isn't it?
You can follow all of our reporting on the Grenfell Tower disaster on our website as the investigations continue at theguardian.com. That's all for this week, and my thanks to Dawn Foster, Raphael Baer and Anne Perkins. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Jessica Elgott, and thanks for listening.